you introduce him as the president-elect of the American Sociological Association. And Eric has very kindly and graciously... Eric has very kindly and graciously agreed to come to PCS today and talk about his plans for the 2012 ASA meeting and Real Utopias. Thanks, Eric.
So, yes, at this year's ASA meeting, I didn't get a ribbon yet on my name tag because they don't have a formal status of the president-elect in waiting. And I only officially became president-elect on the day after the meeting. That's when there's the sort of passing of the baton from the existing president to the then president-elect, who is now president, Randall Collins. And at that point, I became officially president-elect.
Is there a hazing ritual that's involved?
No, there's not. By the way, my thought is to treat this as a kind of meandering exposition rather than a formal presentation about my plans, an opportunity for me to reflect on what this all means. So I'm sure most of you don't even know how the ASA works. I didn't really know how it works until I got asked to be to run for this office. So the procedure is there's a nomination committee, which is itself an elected committee of the ASA, that picks the candidates. Of course, they face the problem that lots of people who they approach with the question, do you want to run for ASA president or any other office, many people say no. So it's not just that they pick two and their first two picks. So I don't know where down the list I was on that year's nomination. I assume they have some kind of system of a rank ordered list of people they will approach. I might have been number 12 for all I know. I have no idea. So, and rightfully, I have no idea how that worked. So I was picked last year and agreed to run eagerly. It's something I actually see as a way of continuing the kind of work I care about in a different venue. The timing was really good because I just finished two long-term book projects that were exhausting, and both in and of themselves, but the fact that there was two that I was doing simultaneously. So this summer I had two books published, one of which was Envisioning Real Utopias. I've been doing work on this Real Utopias theme for a long time now. And so it seemed like a natural thing to do, is to bring Real Utopias to the discipline. So when I was asked if I wanted to run, I eagerly said sure. Wrote up my campaign statement. There's not exactly a campaign for this, but you do write up a personal statement around which there is no guidelines what you're supposed to do. Different people do different things. Some people write a little statement in praise of the ASA. Some announce their academic values, what their particular priorities are. And sometimes people make it clear what they would like to do if they were, what the theme would be. They write essentially a version of the thematic statement. And that's what I did. So I basically wrote about Real Utopias and why I thought this would be an important thing to discuss. Moving towards you get various slogans that you kind of nurture as you think about these things. One of my slogans is a sociology of the possible, not just the actual. That's what the Real Utopias idea is all about. So I ran. The other candidate was Karen Cook, a very strong, established person in the discipline, well-respected. She had a much longer history of organizational involvement in the ASA, and that's one of the things that the ASA president is for. It's a way of recognizing one's involvement in the association, not just one's scholarly and disciplinary reputation. Neither of us saw each other as rivals. I think the nominating committee tries to avoid picking two people to run against each other who, in an academic sense, are rivals. You're shaking your head. They don't try to avoid that?
No, I've been on the nominations committee. All they try to do is they come up. You were right the first time. You come up with a rank order.
Right, but
and they go down and they ask two people to run. And so
But if they were...
Could end up in a situation right. if, say, person two and person three both say yes, you have two people running against each other who are very similar in some way, so it was very...
Right, but I meant that not rivals in the sense that they have been engaged in bitter disputes with each other or something like that.
No, but I mean, it could happen.
It could happen.
It's
okay.
not a consideration.
Okay.
It's a rank-ordered list.
Okay, so it just happens that we reflected rather different stands in the discipline, not ideologically particularly. I mean, there might be that as well, but I meant just in the sense of how we locate ourselves in our work. In any case, I got elected in May and proposed Real Utopias as my theme, which was accepted by the ASA Council, or by Council. I've been told that the word definite article does not go before Council, so that's a rather British affectation, it seems to me. The natural American way of saying it would be the ASA Council, but it's ASA Council, not the Council. They've approved the topic. So the thematic topic is, the name of it is, Real Utopias, : Originally, I just had Real Utopias, but my program committee, in what was actually a very interesting discussion, felt that it needed a subtitle, and we had a good discussion of what would be a good subtitle, and this was actually an amalgam of a bunch of suggestions. So Rhonda Levine, I think, made the key suggestions. Anyway, it's Real Utopias, : Emancipatory Projects, Institutional Designs, Possible Futures. So that's the full gambit. Let me just say a couple of words about the Real Utopias theme, what I'm talking about. Many of you know about this, but I suppose not everybody does. And then some of the ways I'm thinking about having this embodied in the structure of the program. Just one little aside. As far as I can tell, by far the most important thing that the president does is organize the thematic character of the annual meeting and other features of that meeting as well. The president chooses a program committee. The program committee is responsible for the entire program, but in practice, roughly half of the program is effectively controlled by the sections. So roughly speaking, half of the program gets designed by the program committee. A call for proposals comes out in October, so any ASA member can propose a panel. The program committee then goes through those proposals, accepts some, works with people, but also directly organizes roughly 60 or 70 panels at the meeting. So there's 60 or 70, somewhere in that ballpark, panels that will directly revolve around Real Utopias, : Emancipatory Projects, Institutional Designs, Possible Futures. The other responsibilities of the president are to be the chair of the, chair of council for a year, and to sit on the council for 3 years as president-elect, president, and past president. And the council, and council, I don't think I'm ever going to, that's never going to sound right. is the governing body of the ASA, and whenever issues come up of various sorts, council has to decide on them. So an example is there's an issue in front of council at the moment about the ASA endorsing the UN Treaty on the Rights of Children, which the U.S. is the only country not to have ratified the UN Treaty on the Rights of Children. We tend to be outliers on things of this sort. I thought this would be utterly uncontroversial for a kind of resolution of support, but there was some controversy around it, and so it's been delayed for the next council meeting before an actual decision of whether the ASA should formally endorse the principles of it. In my year as president, which will begin next August and go until the following meeting, Some ASA presidents do take on other responsibilities. The ASA executive office says if you want to travel around and give talks, go to parts of the country which you haven't visited and give talks either in departments or in regional meetings, you're free to do so, and they'll facilitate that. And my feeling is it's what I would like to do. I'd like to really treat that as a year in which I have a kind of missionary zeal in spreading the word of real utopias. So my thought is that in the run-up to the actual ASA conference, I'll give lots of talks on this theme, particularly at regional meetings, that it's, the Southern Sociological Association, and there's a mountain association. There's various associations. But some states have their own associations. Wisconsin has a sociological association. So I'm just going to say yes to everything and see what happens. All right, so now let me tell you a little bit about real utopias. The idea of real utopias plays off of what's obviously an oxymoron in the title, in the expression, real and utopia. Utopia are meant to be thoughts of perfect worlds that live in fantasy. The word means nowhere or no place, depending upon exactly how it's translated. And the word real is meant to be the kind of opposite of utopia. It's become quite common to dismiss proposals that are viewed as unrealistic for one reason or another, to dismiss them by saying, that's utopian. It's a common way of rejecting leftist stands in politics is to regard it as utopian. Although one sees that same criticism being raised against libertarians and kind of market fundamentalists, that kind of pure capitalism of unregulated markets is a utopian fantasy. It's not a real possibility. People have said that the Russian people are the only people who've been subjected to two utopian fantasies in one century. So utopianism of pure communism and the utopianism of pure capitalism, and neither works. So utopian and real are not a natural combination. Of course, I'm putting them together precisely as a provocation. And the idea is then to combine discussions which take very seriously our deepest moral aspirations for alternatives to existing structures of inequality, domination, oppression, alienation, whatever rubric you want to specify the core of the moral critique of existing social structures. So to combine a serious discussion of our deepest aspirations around those values with sociologically serious discussions of how institutions work and where real possibilities lie. I like to frame the problem of real utopias within a kind of triplet of ways of thinking about alternatives: the desirability of alternatives, the viability of alternatives, and the achievability of alternatives. Desirability by itself is pure utopianism. That is, if you just talk about the desirability of alternatives and completely bracket the questions of viability and achievability, then you have the utopian imagination. The discussion of achievability by itself is the discussion of pragmatic, short-term, immediate, strategic possibilities, and is very limiting. I locate the real utopias discussion primarily at the level of viability, the viability of alternatives, bracketing pretty much the question of achievability. Not bracketing desirability. I mean, of course, I'm only interested in viable alternatives that are desirable. If they're undesirable, I don't want to study them. But I am interested in thinking about viable alternatives that we don't know whether or not they're achievable. Now, if we had an impossibility theorem, you know, if we had some clear way of demonstrating now that a particular alternative institutional design, although viable, is never in principle achievable, if you could actually show that, then I would say that makes it less interesting. I'm interested in what are ultimately achievable, viable, and desirable alternatives. But I think the problem of achievability, if it's brought to the foreground of these discussions, short circuits the discussion of viability, and particularly shortens the kind of time frame for the discussion. You know, think of it this way. If I were to ask you the question, what kinds of reforms of American institutions do you think will be achievable in the year 2050? You know, 40 years from now, or even 2025, 15 years ago, 15 years from now, even probably 2020, you know. It's hard to even know how to begin the discussion, what's achievable, once you get beyond the immediate and near immediate configuration of forces. Because achievability so heavily depends upon contingent historical facts. And some of which are really contingent, some of which are just not foreseen, but could have been in retrospect. Others are just completely contingent. So I think I put aside the achievability question because it's too hard. I don't think we can say much interesting about what's achievable in the long term. But achieving our deepest aspirations for social justice, human flourishing, that is a long-term project. So the Real Utopias project then focuses on the question of viable alternatives. Of course, it's a problem, how do you study alternatives of any sort? How do you study viable alternatives? What's the method for doing so in a way that isn't just armchair speculative philosophizing? And that, of course, is one of the issues that I hope at the ASA people talk about. You know, the methodological issues of studying possibilities and how to do this in a way that actually has a research component, so it isn't just idle speculation. My own work on Real Utopias has revolved around two different kinds of strategies for studying these ideas. One is to look for prefigurative cases, small-scale instances, historical examples, sometimes not so small-scale instances, that realize some but not all of the emancipatory ideals that I talk about, and to study them with respect to two basic kinds of empirical problems. One is to see how they work, to really try to get a good diagnosis of what it is that makes examples that we think of as good examples and that violate the principles of the dominant system, how do they actually work? But then to look at where the bottlenecks are, where the difficulties they face are, to try to get a diagnosis of where the institutional problems, either internally or in their environment, that prevent either replication or expansion. So I'm doing a project on worker-owned firms at the moment, which has that as its kind of central focus. If you want to think of what is the classic instance of a kind of, quote, real utopian alternative to capitalism, well, right from the start in the 19th century, worker-owned firms were seen as an alternative to capitalist firms. One of the most famous debates of the 19th century, socialism revolved precisely around that between Marx and Proudhon. Proudhon saw the worker-owned firm as the overturning of capitalism. Capitalism is based on the separation of workers from the means of production. The worker-owned cooperative reunites workers with the means of production. And his vision was that these would be so dynamic and attractive and efficient because they could dispense with supervisors and foremen and all sorts of other necessarily inefficient features of capitalism, that worker-owned firms would simply outcompete capitalist firms. Capitalism would crumble because of an inability to recruit a labor force, because workers would opt for worker-owned firms over capitalist firms. That was the, if you will, the vision for how this real utopian alternative could actually then constitute a strategy for transformation, not just an exemplar of an alternative. That's not how things turned out for a variety of reasons. Well, part of my empirical work is concerned with trying to identify where the obstacles are. Why is it that worker-owned firms tend to remain niches and small, and when they grow and become successful, they convert to being capitalist firms? That would be an example. So one of my methods for studying this is to look for prefigurative cases. analyze how they work and diagnose the constraints. And the other is to work more with theoretical models of alternatives, which may build off of empirical cases, but they go beyond them. So the work I've done on unconditional basic income certainly draws some of its analysis from the investigation of various forms of redistributive schemes that exist in social democratic societies and the like. But since no country has ever adopted a full unconditional basic income, one of the closest, which is a unconditional partial basic income, but not an unconditional full basic income, is actually in Alaska, because Alaska has this way of distributing the royalties from Alaskan oil, in which they just write a check for each citizen every year. You get this check in the mail from the government of the state of Alaska, which amounts to a few thousand dollars per person. So it's, you know, it's a partial basic income. You can't live entirely off of it. On the other hand, if you kind of live out in the sticks and cut yourself off from the grid, and you've got a few children and they each get $2,000 or $3,000 a year, you can approach a basic subsistence with the Alaska General Fund subsidy. Still, it's only a partial basic income. So basic income discussions deal with theoretical models of alternatives and how they work, drawing to some extent on empirical cases, but not primarily being empirical. I want to bring the problem of a sociology of real utopias to the discipline in a way that will not seem esoteric and fringy, that will not displace the core of the intellectual agenda of the discipline, of course. I mean, I wouldn't even want that. But which gives it a secure place as a legitimate theoretical and research agenda that graduate students around the country could see as something to try to work on. I'm, in terms of the actual format of the meeting, I have one kind of thematic session which I'm developing, which will be, I think, different from sessions that have existed in at least any ASA that I've been in, and a couple of other ideas. And I thought maybe it might be useful for me just to describe how I plan to structure some of these panels. So the, and by the way, ask, you know, you can ask questions. This is, I'll just keep talking, but don't hesitate to interrupt, raise any issues you might want to. Okay, so one kind of panel which I will develop, I don't know how many of these there will be. My guess is somewhere around 10 or 15 panels will have this structure. The structures will involve recruiting a person, one person, to write a real utopian proposal around some central problem. So, for example, a real utopian design of K through 12 education. What would be the ideal way of organizing public education, K through 12? There's a variety of things on the table that people have talked about. How would you do it if you could design a K through 12 system? Unconditional basic income would be another. Market socialism could be a third. It's easy to come up with a dozen. Recruit a person who's been working on these themes to write a kind of proposal / manifesto. You know, it'd be a document that would lay out the rationale, the critique of existing institutions in brief, the rationale for an alternative, and the central principles of design. Now, some of these will be more like blueprints of design with a lot of detail. Others will be principles of design. That will vary from person to person, depending upon what they've worked on and how they think about it. These documents, this kind of proposal document, will be available by January of 2012. The meeting is in August. And we'll have a website dedicated to the real utopian proposals for the meetings, for these thematic panels. Those proposals will be posted by sometime in January of 2012. The website will have a kind of bloggish structure so that people can write comments and there can be dialogue with the person who wrote it prior to the ASA. Publicity about this will be widespread so that most people will know when they get their ASA programs and begin thinking about what sessions they want to go to, that if they're interested in some of these proposal sessions, they will have the opportunity of reading the core document beforehand. And they'll be encouraged to come to the session with issues they would like to raise, and particularly to share those issues ahead of time, not to come and just raise them from the floor, but there'll be a format for them to do so on the website. At the session, the person who wrote the proposal will give a short 15 to 20 minute distilled discussion of its central ideas. Knowing, of course, that a significant number of people at any session won't have had the chance to read the proposal, and nor should one expect to. It's not meant to be a kind of requirement like in a grad seminar, right, that you do the reading before the session. So there'll be a serious presentation, but of a condensed character. I'm not sure whether there'll be a discussant or not. At most, there'll be one, not a panel. Because I want to maximize the opportunity for discussion from the floor of these proposals. It might be good to have one person have a kind of prepared set of critical remarks or discussion issues to raise. But I think that may vary somewhat from session to session. In some of these, it may be two proposals that are counterposed to each other, not just one, if there is a clear kind of interesting dialogue between two available options. One could imagine for the K through 12 education a contrast between the sort of voucher market-like proposal for public education, where you try to make public schooling as much like a market in education as possible by having the funding entirely follow the kids with vouchers, versus the kind of democratic school proposal for a alternative, where what you try to do is really democratize the structures of, around curriculum and instruction and the like within schools so that you have a more participatory form, but not competition between schools. Those are two kinds of ideas around sort of the real utopia's ideal of how you would do schooling. Conceivably, that would make a nice session as point and counterpoint. I don't know how many of these there will be. My guess is around 15, but it could be with the program committee and with other people, you know, and once the word gets out about how this is going to be designed, other people will come up with proposals for this kind of session. Perhaps this kind of session will expand. Maybe there'll be 20, 25 of them, I don't know. So that's one kind of session. I wanted to span the full gamut of disciplinary themes, so I'd like such a session to be around issues of gender equality. The most recent book in the Real Utopias Project series was on gender, and I know for sure that Janet Gornick and the group around that will be doing stuff. I'd like to have a session on care work. Nancy Fulbray is real interested in doing that. She is head of the SAGE, the Russell SAGE Working Group on Care Work, and very interesting. She's going to be coming to Madison, by the way, in the spring as part of this year's Haven Center series, and among other things, we'll be talking about these themes. So she's agreed to do one on care work. So it'll not be just my main kind of political economy, Marxian class and socialism kinds of things. I would like to see this over the full spectrum of issues that people care about. I suppose somebody will propose animals and society. There's a section at the ASA, for those of you who don't know, one of the sections is animals and society. And people who do research on pets are in the animals and society section of the ASA. but also animal, more generally animal rights kinds of concerns. I would imagine that somebody from that group was going to propose some kind of thematic session or regular session around these themes. So that's one kind of session. Another kind of session I would like to have is one that's centered around documentary films that deal with alternatives. So not documentaries that are mainly critical attacks on existing structures. But, I mean, that may be part of the film, but that a documentary that also explores alternative institution in one way or another. An example would be one of the films that's in the Haven Center in conjunction with the class that Joe Conte and I are teaching separately but using the same films. We have a semester-long film series on Monday and Tuesday nights. And one of the films that we'll be showing towards the end of the semester is called Holding Ground, which is a film about the Dudley Street Neighborhood Association in Boston, where a very poor Cape Verdean and African-American community essentially took command of the planning processes which were being imposed upon that community. And the Neighborhood Association actually won the power of eminent domain. It's the only neighborhood association in the country that has legal powers of eminent domain to appropriate abandoned buildings and turn them into community uses. And that's been going for 20 years, and there's a very nice film about it. It's a wonderful film about that. So I'd like to get a dozen, 15, whatever, films on Real Utopia's themes. I've only got four or five so far that I know of, but I'm sure more will come. I'd like to have one on the kibbutz and the dilemmas and, you know, sort of the unraveling of the kibbutz ideal, but which also then talks about its strengths and so on. There's apparently, although I haven't seen it, a very good film about a community in, I believe, Brazil that has some very innovative public transportation, free public transportation systems, and how it works. But I'm sure once this gets announced, there'll be lots of people. Now, what I'd like then is to have a film shown with then either the filmmaker or an expert on the themes of the film there to lead a discussion of the film afterwards. So these won't just be a film series. They'll be a regular academic session. It'll be inserted into the regular academic program by in which the raw material for the discussion will be a film. I'm thinking at this point of the other thing I have to do is come up with plenaries. So the plenaries are the big featured events that are held in the, whatever is the, it's usually called something like the Empire Room or the Imperial Ballroom, you know, they're terrible names. I'll see if, you know, a nice little touch would be if I could get the hotel to rename the ballroom for the Real Utopia's Ballroom. It's conceivable they'll let me put a little sign over it and we'll change the name for one meeting. Who knows? You know, it's one of my thoughts for the meeting would be that I just have a Real Utopia's plenary in an Imperial Ballroom. It's just too creepy for words. So I'm... In any case, so I'm not sure exactly what would be the optimal plenaries. I'd like one to be a kind of featured plenary where there's a few people who are kind of really important theorists of particular kinds of alternatives, like Philippe Van Parijs from Belgium is the world guru of basic income. He's a very good speaker, a very passionate and engaging person. And he's agreed to come and do a kind of plenary presentation around basic income. One of the principles I want to have for the plenaries is not sometimes at like at this last ASA, they had like a plenary with like eight people giving presentations. I'd like to have many fewer presentations and to have in the plenaries time for interaction from the floor as well for people to react, but not these enormous panels with. And in general, my feeling is that mostly I find discussants in these things not very interesting compared to the presentations. So I want to minimize those unless there's some very good reason for them. So one will be on these major figures who have worked on different themes. I thought a second one on energy and the environment and global warming, given the kind of global crisis character of that theme, and the importance of thinking about the institutional bases for alternatives rather than just always focusing on the catastrophic character of the current trajectory. And the third one, but I don't know if this would work, I was thinking of having sociology as a discipline be the object of our interrogation. What kind of a discipline, you know, the discipline as a social practice, and the ways in which it embodies our ideals of for how civility and academic discourse, and the ways it doesn't, and how this could be enhanced. What's the model for how a discipline should work that we feel? Now, I actually, okay, this is another little biographical digression, because I've been thinking about this a lot. When I started in 1970 at Berkeley as a grad student, I picked sociology because I felt of all the available disciplines, I knew I wanted to be a professor and I wanted to study social justice issues in an academic setting. So that's what I wanted to do. So then I had to pick a discipline. And I figured sociology was the kind of most bullshit discipline that had the weakest boundaries and policed its its children the least. It was the discipline in which Marxist work was certainly seen as one of the founding currents of thought rather than a despised and rejected you know, theoretical set of ideas. So I saw it as a platform in which to do my work, but I did not see it as a discipline to be valued in its own right. Indeed, I framed some of my thinking, as many graduate students did at the time, as Marxism versus sociology. Although I was always on the kind of less strident versions of that. And right from the beginning, I did understand the value of the pluralism of sociology as a discipline, and that it would not be desirable for Marxist theory to become the hegemonic theory within sociology. That would actually be self-destructive. Would not be the ideal intellectual ecology in which to do radical work. That is to be one which obliterated all non-radical work. But nevertheless, I had a much more antagonistic relation. Now, either just because of the old saw about as you get older, you get less radical, you know, you soften up, or wisdom, as I've learned. I've come to value sociology a lot more over the last 40 years. Sentences like that really are incomprehensible to me. I really have come to value sociology a lot more. The discipline, I think, is in better shape now than it was when I started. I think the depth of commitment to its pluralism is serious and kind of robustly valued by people who really dislike the kind of work that others do. So, you know, it's not just that everybody's become an omnivore, it's that people who are completely enamored with high-tech quantitative stuff value ethnographies more now than they did 30 years ago. They were dismissive of work that couldn't live up to certain kinds of, quote, scientific standards in the 1970s. They're accepting of that there are multiple ways to gain insight, and it's hard work and ethnographic work that isn't capable of defeating the most skeptical critic, because, you know, the usual kinds of arguments, nevertheless is a serious and important contributor. So I think we've moved in this more pluralistic kind of way. I therefore also personally feel that sociology matches more what I would think of as, you know, a kind of real utopian way of having an intellectual life in the academy than it did 30 years ago. So I'd like us, so one thought is to have a session that reflects on that issue. What I'm not sure about is whether that could be done in a way that would be actually be interesting, whether that could just end up being a lot of posturing and, you know, vague and useless things being said. But that's at least the third plenary that I'm contemplating. Now, the one other innovation, this is not so much an innovation, it's somewhat of a return to something that did happen a few times in the past. I would like to have a real dance party, a real party for the ASA on Sunday night, as opposed to the collective gatherings only taking the form of receptions where you stand around and nibble. To have a proper party, it needs to be Sunday night because I can't imagine my heart being in it if it was before I've given my presidential address. So it's got to be after I can, it has to be after the point where I'm feeling any stress. Now, since the, so here's the part that might be a little dicey, but, so the conference is in Denver, that's the West, right? We have a Denver, we have a Coloradan in the room. So I thought it would be kind of cool to have a square dance. And to get, and I mean, not that that would be the only thing, you know, I'm just saying that we'd have a party in which we'd get a proper caller who would teach people how to do it and a bluegrass or, you know, old-timey band, and we would have a square dance at the ASA. You know, sort of from 8 to 10, followed by a DJ. You know, so I wouldn't impose the hokey for the whole night on everybody. And depending upon how exuberant I feel, I would arrange with the band that I would bring my fiddle and join them for at least one, you know, one number in the thing. As part of that evening's party, there's also the possibility of having an open call for a jam session. So it could be, that could be another component of it. Just tell anybody who's got musical instruments, wants to bring, we'll just have a jam session that would start, you know, after the dancing. And people don't have to have ever played together for that kind of thing. And usually the people who will bring it are will be reasonably good musicians, so they'll be good at doing that kind of stuff. So that's my other proposal for the meetings. I haven't actually asked the executive committee office, but I assume that the program committee can make such decisions. That's part of the program. You know, it does mean juggling some of the department nights, but a lot of those are on Saturday night anyway, so I don't see any reason why there'd be any objection to it. Well, okay, those are my plans for the meetings and for my year. I'm really, as you can tell, I'm really into this. I have to say, when I was at the ASA this last year, I felt something which I can only, the words that come to mind are sort of love and fellowship. I mean, I really felt that this was my world and my community. You know, I know it's complete. I don't want to overdo this, but I went into some sessions where there were some, you know, graduate students presenting things, and just my heart went out to everybody. I just felt, oh, this is great. Look at all these people. They're earnest. They're trying hard. The level of seriousness with which people were trying to make sense of things was really impressive to me, and I just felt super appreciative of it in a way that all my cynicism just disappeared completely. So I don't know if I'll sustain that naive exuberance the whole time, but that's sort of where I'm at the moment on this anyway. There will be this open call for proposals for sessions, and mostly for what are called regular sessions, but some of those can become thematic sessions as well. You know, it just depends on how close they are to the core of the theme. So if anybody has ideas, and if anybody knows films for the kind of film series especially, everything's open at this point.
Can I ask a question about the, I mean, this is taking a step back from the concrete plans for the AFA meeting, and more about the real utopias idea in general. And, you know, it struck me at the very beginning of your talk here today, in the title, in the subtitle, there's this stuff about institutional design. I know that's a very important part of the Real Utopias project, Real Utopias thinking. I'm curious about what might be considered, the other side of that, in the sense that, it seems that some of the utopian thinking of the past, along with rethinking institutions, there was also this notion of agents, of character, of habitus, of transformation of that. So with the experiment in Soviet socialism, the idea of the new Soviet man, for instance, right? And so I'm curious whether that is a component of how you envision real utopias, and if so, how that fits in and how it relates to this other side of rethinking how we design institutions, how we build and construct institutions.
So first of all, with respect to the meetings, that certainly is in the agenda. So if groups connected to sociology of culture, historical sociology, social psychology, I mean, any of the interest groups in the discipline whose center of gravity is around subjectivity and disposition and so on, wants to approach these problems from that starting standpoint, that's completely legitimate within the meeting, for sure. Now, in terms of my own thinking about it, I certainly do think that subjectivity, values, dispositions, however one wants to package those themes, matter. So the question is, what can we say about them that isn't just hand-waving? So the Soviet new man was certainly hand-waving. They didn't have a clue about how to create new people. They didn't have a theory of the equilibrium process by which institutional designs would engender the kind of people that would fit into those institutional designs, right? So I think it's absolutely important, of fundamental importance. I've discussed it myself a little bit in the Gender Equality Project, where the central theme of that volume in the Real Utopias Project is around the division of labor in the household. The kind of premise of the analysis is that one of the central obstacles to further advances in gender equality more broadly centers around unequal divisions of labor in the household. And how do you change that? Can we think of ways of changing that? And in that problem, one of the questions is, to what extent are men not doing housework and childcare and other caregiving responsibilities, to what extent are they not doing it because of the constraints under which they live, which make it harder, the trade-offs become very sharp, or is it because of their personalities, values, let alone hormones? I mean, there's a full range of possibilities that are more centered around their character as persons. What we could manipulate by design were the constraint part of that equation. That's where we could do something. We could figure out, okay, we can have some new rules of the game around parental leaves that incentivize men taking parental leaves, whereas now they don't. And that would affect their behavior in the household and create the possibility then for a different terrain on which, within families, people could struggle over these issues. So we knew how to talk about that. In terms of how to talk about the character formation stuff, we didn't really have much of a handle on how to approach it exactly. So the one thing I suggested is that we can say something about how to change norms, even if we have a harder time about how to change identities. So norms are what kind of behavior are you expected to do, and what sort of behavior is seen as weird and deviant. And we can change norms by just changing the visible presence of people engaged in a greater variety of activities. So the fact that we see men on weekdays pushing baby buggies in a park makes it normal as opposed to weird. And as things become normal, then to the extent that men would like to do that and they're just feeling they can't do it because it's deviant, then behaviors would change. If the mechanism involved is normative rather than personality, for example, or identity. I do think it's important, but I don't have much of a handle on how you actually do other than say it's important. Yeah.
I think this is pretty exciting, the general theme of real utopias, and specifically those sort of manifesto sessions, and kind of addressing one of the historical shortcomings, I think, of the discipline being policy recommendations. I can envision, a scenario where, you're taking into account, what's going on in the real world, what does the research say about, whatever topic it might be, whether it be the K-12 education or something else, and then being, given a forum in which to recommend, some sort of actual, real vital change. And I think that's really cool. And another thing, kind of methodologically, I think that sort of this sort of theme also invites a lot of quantitative analysis of simulated data. And you can simulate some sort of, world, characteristics of the world around us. And
yeah, we could have SimCity and
I mean, it would be it could get as creative as you'd want it to. But in any case, I think that those two things are pretty exciting about that.
On the policy issue, there's a distinction that I would draw. Now, this may not be a robust distinction, but I would draw the distinction between conventional policy analysis, which constrains the discussion to the achievability problem. It says, here we are, where can we move from here? And the real utopias discussion, which is also a policy discussion, because it's about real institutional change, which says, here we are, where would we like to end up? And then, what are the steps to get from here to there? Now, the where we would like to end up may not be known to be achievable, and may certainly be known not to be achievable right now. So, the purpose of the real utopias discussion with respect to the ordinary policy discussion is that it would help then inform ordinary policy discussions about which of the many possible good things we could do now, some of them can be viewed as stepping stones that move towards some more fundamental transformations, and others are just good in their own right but aren't necessarily such part of such a trajectory. And part of the political underpinnings of the Real Utopias Project is to try to locate sequences of changes with respect to a, quote, destination, even if the destination can only be specified as a set of design principles rather than, quote, policies in the sense of something that you would legislate. And that's clarifying that the relationship between incremental policy and radical change is another one of the things in this agenda. On the simulation, it would be very cool if people who are doing computer games, that kind of like SimCity, SimLife, if we could have a discussion about the creation of social games that enable people to change the rules of the game. I always had this idea that it would be great if some video game person who really knew what they were doing would create a game where the rules of the game, you could decide, are the rules of the game going to be Weberian or Parsonsian or Marxian? And then you could play the game and see how well it simulated the way the world is. And then once you've got a game that under different rules simulates the way the world is, with all of its unpleasantries, you could then play the game of modifying the rules to see what happens. So, but in a way that would actually have a video game-ish type of quality to it. Yeah, Matt.
How, if at all, can you get the sections to move their own sessions in a real utopian direction, or at least to somehow, you know, favor submissions that have a really utopian flavor?
I had an initial idea, which in a brief but important and useful conversation with Myra in the hallway, she quite correctly persuaded me that I should, you know, go cautiously on this. So I had the original idea of saying, look, the program committee has 60-ish, more or less, thematic slots that we can allocate, that we could offer to the sections, that they could, in effect, increase the number of panels they could organize if they would have one that would be a real utopias panel. So that this would be a way of incentivizing the sections to take on the agenda, because they wouldn't be at the expense of their ordinary things. And it would mean that the program committee would have direct and immediate control over a smaller subset, but I thought, you know, 40 or 35 would be plenty. But Myra, it's not that some section could still indeed propose which could in fact have that character.
And in fact, you can send a letter to all of the sections encouraging them, laying out the theme, and specializing per section even.
Right.
You know, with two sentences per section saying, you know, given that, you know, you're the section on families, this is really important to family issues, to imagine the family
roles. But what Myra emphasized to me is we shouldn't in any way abdicate our ability to say no when they when they give us some nonsense proposal with badly thought out, etc. So that I originally wanted to actually empower the sections. You know, this seemed like bottom-up democracy. You know, my impulse was to do that. But then as a person who is president and therefore in the elite position came to realize instantly when instructed by an old hand at these things, Myra was, just so you know, she
I was on the program committee for the past two years.
So when Myra pointed that out, and the thing is, of course, that one, that if you're in the position as president and you're organizing this conference, you want it to be as exciting as possible. And giving up that control had the risk of weakening a key part of the program. So what I would really not like would be to have an array of thematic panels on real utopias where some of them were just terrible. You know, of course some will be better than others, but I would like to avoid that. So I will indeed encourage and invite the sections to actively send us proposals for panels that the sections would be heavily involved in, but I'm not going to give them a carte blanche on that.
And that definitely does work. I mean, Evie Glenn was very active in encouraging the sections to do things on citizenship. And you may have noticed that quite a few sections had things that one way or another did engage with the citizenship theme. And Randy Collins pretty much said, no, why should I interfere with the sections? They should do what they want to do. That's their half of the program. And I doubt very much that we'll see much section input into the broader theme. It's like, no, they should do their autonomous thing. That's their power. They should have their ideas, and I have my ideas, and half the program is plenty. And so it sort of went into quite different directions, and either of them is perfectly fine.
Yeah.
But I think the real utopias one is one that a lot of sections would, like the citizenship one, be pleased to be invited to think about and engage in, and they won't resist using some of their...
Right. So it's both a question of encouraging them to use some of their internal panel planning around that theme, and that planning comes relatively late in the cycle. That is, the sections plan their panels much later than the program committee plans it. So we will have already locked in a bunch of panels, which will be of interest to sections. So in that sense, it's not competing with them.
Right. Well, it's competing with them, too, in the sense that you get to pick the people first.
Right, that's right.
And you get people to commit. And then the sections go around and they say, well, we'd like you to be in the special featured thing. And you say, no, I can't do that because I'm already hooked up into other things. So the advantage to the program committee is deliberate.
Well, it's 1:30. I have a thing at, if there's any last questions or issues otherwise. So anybody, you should all feel free to come and chat with me about it and send me proposals. You know, quite apart from the formal channels, there'll be in the October footnotes the announcement with formal proposal procedures, but I'm happy to be hobnobbed, buttonholed, whatever. Okay.
Thanks, sir.